Hi, everyone. Welcome to Mystifyingly Missing, True Crime and Thought-Provoking Events. My name is Rhonda, and I'll be your host today as we explore a kidnapping case that shook the nation, that had the media falling over themselves to try to get an interview with the kidnapped victim and hero. We'll hear stories from his family, some of his friends, and also from his children, who unfortunately he did not get to spend a lot of time with. Today we will be talking about the kidnapping of Stephen Stainer. As a warning before I get into any details, any episode that I cover on this podcast can include discussions about death, suicide, violence, and a number of things that may be triggering. So this is the warning before we go forward. This will involve abuse of children, a death, and a lot of things that are very uncomfortable to talk about. This is another episode where I'm exploring siblings. Previously, I had done an episode on one brother who had killed two people and shot a number more on the East Coast here in Delmarva, as well as his brother who killed someone during a purported drug deal. In this case, it's a little different. The first brother that we're talking about today was seen as a hero by most. What his family endured and what he went through is unimaginable, to say the least. We can also see the way that the world looked at kidnappings, victims, the law, and psychology from the 70s to today, so about a 50-year time period. And I think you'll be pretty surprised by some of the things that went on. I know I was frankly surprised, and I can't imagine some of these things happening today. It's for those reasons why I'm doing a case that is more high profile. I believe, you know, probably a lot of people have heard of at least one of the Stainer brothers, but if you haven't, you'll be learning more about them today. This will be two parts, as you know, I think each brother getting their stories across really needs an episode each. So let's get into it. There's something that many of us in the true crime community, especially whether we're creators, listeners, or both, we hear this phrase a number of times. It was a parent's worst nightmare. But that can apply to so many things. I remember one day I had a meeting at work and I didn't have my cell phone out during that time. You know, we weren't supposed to have them out. However, we could check them on our way back to our desks from the meeting. And when I opened my phone, I saw a number of missed calls and voice messages. The earliest message was a recording saying that your child was not in school today. The problem was my children were way too young to leave campus on their own. And as my parents got them on and off the bus, I knew that my mom would have at least texted me to let me know that one of the boys was sick. But this was followed by other voicemails, one of my mom sounding very panicked, my husband crying on another one, and all I could think of was my older son was left on the bus. He's on the autism spectrum, and at that time, he was not as communicative as he is today. He'd been sent to school early to try to help with these things, but even at this time, his younger brother, who was about 21 months younger, really was the spokesperson of the two. And I just kept thinking that the bus driver may not have checked. My older son didn't recognize that he needed to say anything to get off, or that he was confused or anything like that. And that my younger son didn't realize anything was wrong. And everybody just got off and left my older son on there. This was all going through my mind. I couldn't even hit the number to dial the bus driver. But I did finally manage to get through to my mother And she said that my dad had actually already made it to the school. Now, it's about a 12-minute drive from my parents' house to the school, and my mom said he made it in like 5 minutes. So, yeah. Now, shortly after my dad got into the school, they shut the doors and didn't let anybody back in. What had happened was their automated system had accidentally sent the same message out to every single parent and emergency contact, which explains how my parents got the message, and gave the same recording. So people had begun to show up in droves at the school, desperate, because for one thing, you couldn't get through on the phone because so many people were calling. So then other parents and grandparents were jumping in the car and trying to get to the school. And in my time frame, it only took about 3 minutes to figure out what was going on, because by then, everybody else had done all the panicking. They had done all the calling. My husband talked to me and he was mad at me. He said I wasn't emotional enough. And I told him, you know, he was so upset, somebody needed to try to calm down and think. So we were handling things differently. But after everything was settled and I knew my son was okay, I went into a colleague's office and I cried. But knowing what I felt like in just those 3 minutes, the story that I'm about to retell seems like it would be an ongoing, never-ending horror story. So at the time of this event, or I should say ongoing event, Stephen Stainer's parents would have this never-ending gnawing in the pit of their stomach, this worry in the back of their head, and many times probably in the forefront of their mind. So what happened? Stephen Gregory Stainer was born on April 18th, 1965. When he was 7 years old in December of 1972, he was thrust into a multi-year imprisonment when he was kidnapped by a man named Kenneth Parnell. Stephen was a middle child of five children. He was the third. He had an older brother, Carrie, one older sister, and two younger sisters. He lived in Merced, California, and he was really just that proverbial third child or that middle child to his parents, Delbert and Kay Stainer. Now, for those of us living in 2020, in not even a new decade, but even a new millennium from the time where Stephen's story takes place, we'll see a big difference. Kids used to be able to run around and be free outside without as much worry as we have now. I grew up riding my bike to visit friends because I lived quite a distance from any other child my age. You know, I remember, though, even years after, you know, Stephen's case, my friends, my sisters, we would all do that. You know, we didn't live in cities where there, you know, were blocks or neighborhoods of houses, but, you know, we also didn't have things inside to play with. So once summer hit, once, you know, there was a vacation, everybody was just outside playing. And also children as young as Stephen could walk home from school. And while some school districts still have children of certain ages walk home, such as my kids are old enough that if you're not able to drive them, the bus will not pick them up. They have to walk to school. So it may be different in different areas of the country now, but overall, across the United States at this time, you know, the 60s when Stephen was born and the 70s when he was taken, kids would be walking to and from school and all around the neighborhood. The fateful day where evil would first enter the Stainers' life was in December of 1972. Stephen had ventured home from school hundreds of times, and no one in Stephen's life could have imagined it, but a convicted child predator with an accomplice, and I will use the term predator or other terms as I do upload this audio to YouTube and they don't like certain words. But Kenneth Parnell was the predator with the assistance of a man named Irvin Murphy, and together they took Stephen. Kenneth was a little bit far away from his place of birth when he took Stephen. Purnell had been born in Texas in September of 1931, and he was born during the Great Depression, so he didn't really enter this world and have a great childhood. It set forth for him, just through the circumstances that he was born in and what the country was going through, that he would have a pretty rough childhood. He had two half-sisters and a half-brother. His father had actually left them when Purnell was about 6 years old. Then his mother moved out to California, Bakersfield to be exact, with him and his siblings. And though we don't have the specific instances to know what he did, it was known that he did spend a good portion of his childhood in either juvenile detention centers or mental institutions. One of the first accounts that we have about his actions took place in 1951. Using the ruse of being a police officer, he had tried to assault a child, and he succeeded in that. He had somehow located an actual real sheriff's badge in a store, and this convinced the child that he really was a policeman, and he trusted him. So Purnell was sent to jail with a 4-year prison term, and while he escaped, he was eventually recaptured. And the reason why he kidnapped and assaulted this young child will probably make you cringe even more than you probably already are. At the time of the abduction, this unnamed little boy who was hurt and assaulted by Purnell, the reason this was done was because Purnell's wife was pregnant, and so to use his words, he had to, quote, find another outlet, end quote. So this adult man had so little control over himself that while his wife was pregnant, he found it okay, in his eyes at least, to hurt a child. And so this means, yes, Purnell was actually married. He was married at least twice, as those marriages can be verified, but some places state that he was married 3 times, and sometimes he states that. So I almost wonder if he was in a common law situation or cohabitation where they didn't have the legal documents, but they still lived together as man and wife. Because, of course, back then, unmarried people couldn't live together, so he had to, you know, keep a cover, I guess, to make it look like he was family oriented. But this is just my speculation here. In regards to his first arrest in 1951, looking at his age, he probably would have been married to his first wife at that point because he would have only been 20. He had married this wife in 1950, so he would have been 19 then, and his daughter was born in 1951. But he did not stay married to his first wife very long, and I'm thinking that's probably because he spent about 4 years of it being in jail. They divorced in 1957, and so they were married for about 7 years. And just as a kind of side thought here, I know that at the time divorce was less common, but if my husband had been sent to jail for something like that, I'm divorcing him so quickly and getting out of that marriage, taking my child and getting as far away as I can from that situation. But I didn't live in those times, so I can't say necessarily really what type of pressure she must have been under. But I'm glad she at least was able to get away from him and divorce him, and that most of the time that they were married, he was in jail. About 10 years after he was first sentenced for this crime, he committed an armed robbery in the state of Utah. That's where his second wife filed for divorce. So again, there's not always dates that are listed, but based on the wording, he probably didn't stay married to his second wife that long either, because it says 10 years after he was first sentenced. I'm taking that to mean, you know, in 1951 or 52, when he got that sentence, and by the time he got out, he really couldn't have been married to the second wife for decades. Even before the kidnapping we're going to be discussing, we will see that he was no angel. He was working at a resort at Yosemite National Park, and you may just want to keep that in mind for next episode. And he worked with a man named Irvin Murphy. However, Mr. Murphy was a little developmentally delayed, and in the terms that were used, it said he was slower to learn things. A lot of people would say he was very trusting and naive. So, you know, when you look at all these things, it probably would have been easy for Kenneth Parnell to try to manipulate and use Mr. Murphy, you know, in really an abhorrent manner. So again, using a subterfuge, they acted as men ministering to the religious needs of the community, and they were handing out flyers, you know, along the way in Stephen's neighborhood. And they said that Murphy basically was like a pastor or minister in training. One of the ways that Parnell manipulated Murphy was he said he wanted to kidnap a child to raise, and quote, a religious type deal, end quote. This is what Murphy said. Murphy was the one who actually did the physical act that led to Stephen being kidnapped. But here again, Parnell is preying on the innocence and the naivety of a young child, and in this case, probably his accomplice. What they did is, again, posing as ministers, said that they were collecting things and would his mother like to donate anything to the church. Stephen, being trusting of adults, being trusting of people that he thought were part of a church community, thought that, yes, his mother would like to donate things. And they offered him a ride home so he could get there faster. He accepted, and this is where Stephen's life changed forever. Instead of heading home, the white Buick that Stephen had just gotten into was heading in a different direction. He entered that car under the guise of helping those in need, but they took him far from his own home. I can only imagine the confusion and fear as he watched the surroundings change around him. But actually, some things would become a little familiar. Stephen was taken to a cabin in a place called Kathy's Valley. One of the most heartbreaking parts of this case is at that cabin, it was so close to his grandfather's home. His maternal grandfather lived only hundreds of feet from the cabin that Stephen would be initially held at. We don't know if Parnell knew this, but I think the odds of this happening are really just beyond my grasp. Even, you know, though, if you recall one of my previous episodes, a kidnapped victim was dropped off hours away from where she was kidnapped from, but very close to where her mother had lived. So I just can't imagine years later realizing that at one point he had been so close to one of his, you know, closer relatives. I'm not going to go into extreme details, because I think we can all imagine what must have started happening almost immediately to this young boy. From day one, Stephen was abused, with that abuse getting more and more severe. Of course, Stephen was begging to go home. He was missing his family, and I'm sure he just wanted a hug from his mother and father to feel safe and secure again. But of course, Parnell wasn't going to let that happen. And he was not only abusing him physically. He began a form of emotional abuse, which may not have seemed that way at the time, as it was still being used as the ruse to keep Stephen from trying to go home. But Parnell told Stephen that he now had custody of him. He told him that his family couldn't afford all of the children anymore, and they had gone to court, and basically his parents had given him to Parnell. So given this description and statement that Parnell told Stephen, I do have to wonder if he was familiar with the family, since the cabin that they were initially staying at was so close to the grandfather's, if maybe at times he had observed them coming to visit and took that opportunity one time to follow them home, or, you know, even just talking in casual conversation to his neighbor, ask about the family. But it sounds like he knew something about Stephen's family. It could have always been, of course, gleaned in conversation between Stephen and Parnell themselves, but I really do wonder if it was because he had noticed him at the grandfather's cabin. Kay, Stephen's mother, in the days, weeks, months, then years, didn't want to leave the house unattended. If she had to leave, she wanted someone there in case there was word or there was a call about Stephen. Remember, this was a time before cell phones. In the meantime, Kenneth Parnell changed Stephen's name to Dennis, knowing that he could not keep a child hidden for so many years. He actually did enroll Stephen in school, but under the name of Dennis Gregory Parnell. He did use Stephen's correct birth date as well as correct middle name. Sometimes it would be easier then for Stephen to remember certain things, yet still not be associated with a missing child. Back then, there would not have been any type of cross-check or red flags that would have come up. And sometimes, even today, I don't think that every school, district, or even state has some type of system that would catch these red flags. You know, again, it must just be depending on the district and state. It can just vary, as currently some school districts have very strict requirements, even to homeschool, while others have very lax requirements when it comes to that kind of thing. They lived in many parts of California, and Parnell would usually take up some type of menial jobs. And Stephen had been so young when he had been indoctrinated by Parnell to believe that his family didn't want him. To keep Stephen more compliant, or at least this is my thoughts about it, but he would allow Stephen to use substances. He would allow him to drink alcohol. He could smoke. You know, he really could do whatever he wanted there. And that both affected Stephen by a young child whose brain is still developing, having the use of, you know, alcohol that cannot be good in any way. But as Stephen grew older, Parnell began to trust him more and more. And so there were times where Parnell would leave him at home alone, and Stephen did not try to leave. Now, to throw back a little bit into the 80s, when I was growing up, we watched a show called Rescue 911, and that shows the importance of knowing how to get access to emergency help. But that show was not around in Stephen's day. Looking at the 911 system, I have heard of it being used around those times, but I can't say how aware of the 911 emergency system that someone of Stephen's age would have really known. He did not summon any help from his teachers or anything like that. But this makes sense. It's because he always thought that Dennis was his guardian. And while Stephen was going through this abuse, Parnell was the one who provided him with everything, with food, with shelter, with clothing. And he probably already had this sense of abandonment, thinking that his parents didn't want him. And so it would have been even more frightening for a child to go out on his own in this world. At least for many children, that could be their reaction, and even some adults if they're held captive in similar situations. At one point, Parnell also gave Stephen a dog. The dog's name was Queenie, but It's not like Parnell actually went out of his way to get this dog. Parnell's mother is the one who got it for Parnell, and he in turn gave it to Stephen. And again, some speculation on my part here. I wonder if he spun this event to look better in Stephen's eyes. You know, if his mother had not given him that dog, would he have actually gone out and bought one for Stephen? And Stephen is now growing. He's getting close to his teens, and he did begin to make a good group of friends that would hang out a lot of the time. In one instance, Stephen got a bike for Christmas, and one of his friends asked if he'd been able to call his mom for the holiday, but he said he couldn't. Also, Stephen didn't want anyone coming over to his house. From the outside looking in, these friends may have even thought that Stephen's dad, Parnell, in actuality, was a pretty cool dad for letting Stephen smoke and drink. One expressed regret that she didn't know, and during an interview that I saw from a Hulu documentary series that recently came out, she cried at the knowledge and hindsight that Stephen had been kidnapped and abused. But it's knowledge and hindsight. She didn't know at that time, and they were all children. So none of them could have known what was going on in that home. And unfortunately, the family, the Stainer family, did have to deal with things that most of us can't understand under any circumstances. But some people would give false tips about who may have murdered or taken Stephen. One person said that, and I'm paraphrasing here, that they thought that the family needed some closure, so they thought they would confess to burying him. And sometimes the family would even send the kids away to go somewhere else because of what was being said around the area. They also did not really discuss it much at home. Stephen's younger sister, Corey, and just said, because he has this brother, Carrie, just remember, Corey is the sister, Carrie is the brother. His younger sister, Corey, asked their grandma one day what happened to Stephen, and one of the older sisters told her to be quiet. Corey also mentioned that for Carrie, he was the oldest, and he probably understood what was going on the most. Then, what could have been a possible savior to Stephen ended up being the beginning of more abuse. Parnell met a woman named Barbara Mathias, and she moved in with him for about a year and a half. However, Mathias was definitely not the maternal type and did absolutely nothing to protect Stephen from repeated assaults. In fact, she actually participated. She even tried to assist Parnell on kidnapping another child. And just to cover my bases, she was never charged with anything, so I just can say that this is what's alleged to have happened at times. Just to be safe, and then I'm covering all my bases. The woman said she did not know that Stephen was the missing child, Stephen Stainer. She just knew him as Dennis, and then once everything came out, a kidnap victim. Okay. While in my opinion, she may not have known for sure that Stephen was kidnapped, wouldn't someone think it was a little bit odd and then begin to doubt whether or not Stephen was this man's son, or Dennis as she knew him, was this man's son when he at one point asked you to participate in kidnapping a child? That should set off some red flags. But also, again, she actually assaulted him, saying so at times herself. So, you know, can we really understand her or even kind of try to understand her thought process? I don't think any of us can. But the opportunity to escape came in an unexpected way. In February of 1980, about 7 years after he'd been kidnapped, this was in, you know, again, February of 1980, Parnell was now not as content with Stephen. Stephen had, you know, hit puberty. He was growing up into a young man. And sometimes these predators have a quote unquote type. So Stephen was becoming too old for him. And these predators do not stop. Though I am by no means a criminal expert or psychology expert, it's known that most of the time predators have certain ideals that they look for, and Stephen was just aging way past that. He would now then try to kidnap other children, and he wanted to use Stephen as a lure. However, he wasn't successful in these attempts, and this made Parnell believe that Stephen just maybe wasn't great at luring people to the house or to Parnell. But I did also see in an interview with Stephen where he said he just told Parnell no. It could have actually been a combination, in my opinion. He may have started out pretending that he was trying to help, but then finally just told Parnell no, or vice versa. And so after he was having no luck with getting Stephen to act as a lure, Parnell turned to one of Stephen's friends named Randall Poorman to lure another child. And this child was a 5-year-old named Timmy White. The kidnapping of Timmy White took place on February 14th. And Stephen, he actually came home and found this little boy at the house, and Parnell introduced him as your new little brother. Stephen, knowing what he had gone through over the past 7 years, really saw that Timmy was scared and hurt, and Stephen could not stand to see him like that. After so many years of Parnell leaving Stephen on his own, he probably thought that Stephen wouldn't try to escape, and Parnell did decide to leave. Leaving Stephen and Timmy at the home. He went to a security job one night, and Stephen took Timmy and hitchhiked with him back to the town that Timmy was kidnapped from, Ukiah. Stephen describes his mindset at the time as realizing that they couldn't just walk. Timmy had suggested just walking, even though it really was quite a distance. But Stephen was scared that if Parnell got off of his security job before they could really get out of the area, that he would see them walking, he would take them back, and then things would be worse than they even were. So they did decide on hitchhiking, with Timmy sometimes riding on Stephen's back. Stephen said, "It was my do or die chance, and I also would be coming home for doing something positive." So it really took the idea and thought that this little boy would be going through the same things he had gone through for him to say, "I have to leave." And he was very brave to try to go out like that because, yes, at any time, who knows if Parnell would have, taken a break from work or had been on lunch and actually came home and find them. And even though now we really look at hitchhiking as just a non-mode of transport, we wouldn't do that. But back then, it was still kind of commonplace. And once they did get to Ukiah, Stephen looked at Timmy and told him to go in there and, tell them who he was and that he'd been kidnapped. And so it did not take long for police to act at all. There had been pictures of Timmy all around, looking for him. So it was big news at that time. When Stephen did leave with Timmy, it was March 1st, but by the early morning of March 2nd, Parnell was arrested for both kidnappings. They, looked into his past and found his previous conviction of assault on the child back in 1951. And really, honestly, I'm amazed at how quickly they found that out, considering it was 1980 and there weren't, these centralized databases. What if he'd been using a different name at that time? Because back then you could kind of easily use a different identity. Not completely easy to do so, but, as you could see with Stephen becoming Dennis, it wasn't incredibly hard, though, either. So did they know exactly where to look for Purnell's history, or did someone remember him? But even though I'm not 100% familiar with how they were able to find it so quickly, the good news is that they did, so they knew exactly the type of person that they were dealing with. Both the White families and Stainer families were reconnected and reunited. When police showed up in the middle of the night at the door and Kay answered, she thought it was about her older son, Kerry, as he had gone camping and thought maybe something had happened and it was bad news. But they said that they had Timmy and he was at a police station in Ukiah. They couldn't see him immediately, and they actually first saw him for the first time on TV and could see how much he'd grown and what he looked like then. During the initial interviews with police, Stephen denied that there had been any type of sexual abuse. But then police officers found pictures. So this man also took pictures of a young child, which unfortunately we know all too well that it does happen, which led to more questioning of Stephen. And looking back at that time frame, it just was not discussed the way it is now. Yes, there's still privacy that we look at now, but we also let our children know that it's okay to let an adult know if they're being abused in that way. But back then, it was kind of a taboo subject, even though it was hurting the child. Now, before anybody really knew about this type of abuse as well, Stephen was being interviewed. There was press all around. And Dell, the father, when he saw him during an interview, said that he looked shaky. When discussing Stephen's demeanor or manner, Dell said that he was nervous but great. Kay said that it was scary, and this was because he was really almost a grown man by this point. And by the time they got home, it was 1 o'clock in the morning. Stephen's little sister, Corey, hadn't been able to sleep until her big brother, who she hadn't seen in 7 years, when she was only 4 years old when he was kidnapped. She couldn't sleep in anticipation of seeing her big brother again. Now, Kay had never lost hope. She always knew that he would be found, and she wanted to share the happiness and the outcome with the world, but Stephen just wanted to be alone with his family. You know, he said during his ordeal that he tried to remember his family. You know, that kind of kept them in his mind. But police would not let him discuss his ordeal to the media. So at many times, there was a police officer standing right next to Stephen when he was given any type of interview. Now the media, okay, I saw some clips of things. Some clips were from a movie that was made about this, and others were clips from the actual interviews. Just to let you know, this was from the Hulu documentary as well, which was really well done, I think. But as far as what the media did, they would ask questions that we would in no way allow today. They were getting, you could tell they were trying to ask him about any type of sexual abuse that he may have had done to him without actually saying those words. I couldn't believe it when I was seeing them. It was too intrusive. I know the media needed to get the story, but just some things. I mean, this is a young child who'd been through hell, and this is what the media is trying to do. Something else is, again, 1980s, the schools did not have like a fence or a lockout door or things like that. Media would actually show up at his school after he restarted school and just give out information that they didn't need to give out, such as, you know, his schooling had been intermittent throughout the years with Parnell. So, you know, they would say that he was behind, and it just felt like he was being used all over again. And it was just really, in my opinion, disgusting, some of the things that they were asking or how they were trying to float around the subject. On the other hand, I don't know if it was naivety or what. There were other things that were said where it's almost like they didn't think this happened or couldn't understand what type of abuse he was going through, such as when a police officer would be asked if they knew the motive. No, maybe he just wanted a little, you know, some sons, and this was the only way he knew to get some children. Yeah, multiple people actually said that kind of idea, that he just wanted to have children, and, you know, he didn't have a wife, so he had to kidnap children. Again, don't know if they were just being completely naive, if they were in denial, if this just was not discussed about at all, and people really were in the dark about what kind of abuse could happen. I don't know. But it was unbelievable, just, you know, the naivety almost that they expressed. Getting back to what Parnell now would be facing. Because the kidnappings were separate incidents in two different counties, he had two separate trials. And you may get extremely, extremely mad at this. In the first trial, and this was for Timmy, he was sentenced to 7 years and was paroled after 5. But then to go back to Stevens, the trial about Stephen and being held captive there, he was also sentenced to 7 years. But, get this, the maximum that could be served in California at that time was 7 years. And they didn't take into account that he had kidnapped two separate children on two separate dates and did multiple lewd acts to them. So those years ran concurrently because the judge could not sentence him to any more than 7 years. So since he was paroled at 5 years, he actually served less time in prison than he held Stephen captive for. So it was 7 years that Stephen was away from his family and his family worrying about him, not knowing what he was going through. 7 years that affected his educational growth, his emotional growth, his mental growth, and where he had to endure physical abuse. And Parnell served less time in prison than he held Stephen in captivity. He actually wasn't even convicted or tried for any of the assaults that he committed. That was because it was a jurisdictional situation. You know, what place or what jurisdiction did the assaults take place in? He had taken them from one area and then moved them to another area. There was the statute of limitations for some things that he did that played into how much time he got. So this is just amazing that through all of these loopholes, these gaps in the law, that he would be able to hold a kidnapped child and abuse them for that long and still really serve a very minimal, minute sentence. The assaults seem to have taken place in Mendocino County, but the Mendocino County prosecutors decided not to charge Parnell. But this is my, at least in some states that I've heard, if there is a continuation of an event, then the statute of limitation continues. So let's, and this is just an example I've seen before, but again, I guess it must be different states, that if you've been blackmailing someone and, you know, finally that person goes to the police, they start the statute of limitations from the date of the last payment. So let's just say someone's been blackmailing you for 6 years. The statute of limitations is 4 years, because that person has continually been accepting payments, that four-year statute of limitations would not start until the last payment that you made to them. And honestly, that's the way it should be, because otherwise somebody could hold someone, like in this situation, so long and commit vile acts against them, but in the long run, even though they're still kidnapped, not be able to charge them for it. During the trial, the media did describe Stephen as nervous but emotionless. And that, to me, was probably he was trying to compartmentalize, kind of as a survival mechanism because of everything he'd been through. But we also then need to look at the accomplices. The man who helped kidnap Stephen, Irvin Murphy, and the boy who helped kidnap Timmy, who was named Randall, they were convicted of lesser charges. They stated that they didn't know that Parnell was going to be assaulting the children, and Stephen, in a gracious act of forgiveness and understanding, stated that he thought Murphy was a victim of Parnell as well. You know, I stated before that Murphy was seen as naive and may have been manipulated by Parnell. Stephen said that when Murphy was there, he was very kind to him. However, Barbara Mathias, the woman who helped Parnell assault Stephen when she lived with them for 18 months, the woman who tried to lure other victims, wasn't ever charged at all. So there was a positive change that came about because of this. The laws were allowed to, or changed to, quote, allow consecutive prison terms in similar abduction cases, end quote. So in other words, instead of it being the 7 years concurrent, it would have been 7 years consecutive, making it 14 instead of just the seven. It was just another injustice, though, that he didn't even serve the whole 7 years, that he just, you know, just served the five. The family also was trying their best to adjust. A reporter asked Carrie about how he was adjusting one time and even pointing out that for 7 years he had had his own room and now he was dealing with a national spotlight, his family adjusting to Stephen being back home, and at the same time sharing a room. Yes, the media was focusing on, hey, you have to share a room with your brother now. Corey, who again was the younger sister, she described herself as being annoying, the annoying little sister a lot of the time. She would ask Stephen about what happened to him, and, you know, initially he didn't say, but, you know, she described herself quite a few times as annoying. She kept asking, and finally he told her. Someone who was asking a question off camera asked if she had regretted it, and she said that she, and I'm paraphrasing again, that she regretted both. She regretted asking, and she regretted knowing what had happened. And even though it was recognized that Stephen would probably need some counseling, and though he did attend some very limited counseling, it was not really an extended treatment. And this may go back to the mindset and thoughts of the day, but Stephen's sister revealed that she felt Stephen didn't get more treatment because their father didn't think that he needed it. But beyond just dealing with the changes in his home life, he had to deal with the notoriety that came with the abduction and his return home. And while today, you know, we see bullying in schools and we try to teach children to say something, you know, this wasn't really discussed back then. If there was a school bully, for the most time or most part, people just kind of dealt with it. So poor Stephen was getting teased about everything from, you know, what happened to him, and people were using slurs. People were jealous of the attention he was getting. So it was just awful for him to be in school, and he actually dropped out because he was getting bullied so much. Even though he never got into a lot of detail about what actually occurred to him in public, you know, the other children at the school must, I think, known a little bit. And some of them may have known a lot about what happened, meaning I'm sure that there were children in that school being abused as well. Probably not kidnapped, but abused as well, and they felt like they couldn't come forward either. You know, and now I'm just thinking about it, you know, just as I'm talking, you know, maybe if Stephen hadn't been bullied, if some children there who were being abused in any way had seen, you know, him being treated with any type of respect or empathy or compassion, or had seen that he was able to go on and continue to go to school, maybe that would have helped give them the strength to come forward. So that bullying may not have just affected Stephen. It could have affected others who were going through something very similar. And I also have to think, you know, the teachers must have seen what was going on or heard what was going on. You know, did they just see it as normal growing pains, that there's going to be bullies no matter what, and that bullies were, you know, targeting someone who had made the national spotlight? I just can't imagine every single staff member, faculty member, not knowing that something was happening and not stepping in. Unfortunately, Stephen and his father, their relationship at times may have been a little strained, and at times they would butt heads, and Stephen began to drink more to the point that he was actually kicked out of the house. So that's just mind-boggling to me, but I wasn't there. Still, though, he was gone for 7 years and went through hell, and he was kicked out. But that's just my opinion on that. He took a chance and escaped to save another child, and he gets kicked out of his house. But Stephen did crave normalcy in his life, and in 1985, at the age of 20, he married Jody Edmondson, who was 17 years old at the time. Now, there was a movie made about Stephen's story, and in that, Jody is kind of dramatized. They meet earlier on, like while they're still in school, but in actuality, he met Jody when he was working at a butcher shop. So, of course, for TV, they want to sensationalize things, as well as they only have so much time to get the story in. So if they can move that meeting, you know, closer to when he was younger and when he was going through stuff at school, they could skip the part about when they actually met. So it was interesting. In the Hulu special, they actually had some audio tapes of what the writer, director, everybody was talking about or thinking about you know, during the making of the movie. And you hear them kind of brainstorming about how did they bring Jody into the story. So if you watch the movie, there are some things, yes, that are dramatized and sensationalized some. But Jody and Stephen did have two children together, a daughter named Ashley, and later a son named Stephen Jr. And while Stephen himself didn't get to experience the counseling and therapy that he probably needed, he did work with groups and gave talks to children about safety. And I have to wonder if this was a form of counseling for him, you know, that helped him cope, since he didn't have that time with a therapist when he was younger. Now, I have mentioned the movie that was made. It was a mini-series that aired on, I believe, NBC, and it was named I Know My First Name is Stephen. Now, at the time that this came out, I was very young, and I probably did not understand the context of the movie. We actually watched it, and I watched it too, because really, we didn't have like tons of channels at the time. We might have only had one TV, or I know there was a time where we did have two TVs, but one only had those old rabbit ear antennas. So it may have been I was just watching the movie because that was what we had to watch. But looking back at it, I know if that was on, I wouldn't let my children who are old, or at least one of them is older than I would have been, I would not let him watch the movie. We've had discussions, of course, as any parent would, about you know, what to do if they've ever felt uncomfortable, you know, things like that. But to watch a movie on a kidnapping like this, I just don't think I'd be able to do that. So he was actually an advisor on the movie, and he played an extra. So if you watch the movie, there's a time where Steven is coming home, again, played by Corey Nemec, and he's being kind of flanked by police officers who are trying to guide him past the, deluge of media and people all around him. So he's the police officer who has the mustache kind of off to a side, if you ever, get to see that. And I think he wanted to go into law enforcement as well. He was taking courses for it. Now, there were some kind of mixed ideas about the movie and how it was perceived. I've seen some people say Steven hated it. Some people say he loved it. What it did do is, of course, he did make some money from it. Not a huge amount. It's not like he made millions, but he did make some, and that would allow him to provide for his family better. Steven's mother, Kay, she didn't like the way the family was portrayed. Now, like I said, at this time, it was in 1989 that the movie came out. And looking back, I remember some conversations that I heard about the movie. And I'm shocked and appalled at what I would hear some people say. Again, not a lot of channels, so if people are going to be talking about something, it's not like, they have 8,000 shows they can discuss. Not every place had access to cable at that time. Definitely no internet or Wi-Fi. But there were so many people saying, well, he could have just left, or why didn't he just leave? And it seemed like Steven was being belittled by some adults. They believed that he was either complicit in the crimes, and some even thinking that he wanted to be there. So to make this clear, this is 100% not my opinion that he was complicit or saying that he could just leave or that he wanted to be there. No, not at all. At 7 years old, he has no ability to make any decision like that. I hope that currently we're in a place where we understand the psychological and mental trauma that one goes through when experiencing something like this. An older person was grooming him into exactly what they wanted. They lied and manipulated. They took away what he valued most, his family. And Parnell did his best to erase that family from Steven's past. And I do think today we have a better understanding of this. I know when looking at the case that Parnell was what Steven knew. He was the one providing the shelter and the food and the clothes and occasionally a treat like a dog. So Parnell knew instinctually almost what to do to try to get Steven to stay with him, but it was in no way on Steven's shoulders that he could have just left. As we can see, when he did leave with Timmy, he was worried about Parnell seeing them and trying to take them back and then even being worse than it was before. So again, I'm just really appalled at any point in time where someone might have thought this as being accurate, that he had a say in it. Now, going to Steven kind of in general, some of his, I guess you'd say, personality traits, going forward, his mother said that there were a lot of girls who would chase Steven, but that, quote, Jody was the one who caught him, end quote. Jody, who again is Steven's wife, said he was more grounded and calm than others his age. So, he was more mature because, again, he grew up in a very quick time because of what he was going through. This is one of the places that I hear someone say that Steven was happy with the way the movie turned out, where others, you know, again, I hear him say he really wasn't thrilled. So we'll unfortunately never really know. During the making of that movie, they did go to Hollywood. Again, it put some money in his growing family's pocket, and it allowed him kind of just to be part of that movie by being able to participate as the extra. Kay's response was that it was, quote, twisted and ridiculous, also saying that it pissed her husband off. When it did air, it was the highest rated NBC miniseries in 5 years, and, you know, it should have, and I hope it did, start conversations about, you know, what someone can go through, what they need as far as support afterwards, and trying to discuss with children, you know, at a children or a child's level for them to understand what's appropriate and not what's not appropriate, and most importantly, don't get into cars with strangers. Now, during the Hulu documentary, and I'll leave a link to it if you do have Hulu, they actually had the actors who played Steven and Carrie do the interviews. And Todd Andrews played Carrie Stainer, the older brother. And one of the dialogues, or I guess monologues really, that he read seemed to denote that Dell was, quote, mean after Steven disappeared. Carrie, when looking at his father, described him as the Rock of Gibraltar and saw him cry for the first time after Steven was taken. That Dell would actually drive around and look for fresh cut dirt or fresh dug dirt. And he would stop and check them because he was looking for graves. He saw everywhere, you know, or looked for signs of his son. And as far as the actor who played Steven, Corin Nemec, hearing him read the lines was surreal. Really, it was. And I just think they picked the perfect actor for that role. When he was reading them, it felt like it was someone who lived those experiences talking to you. And Steven's daughter, Ashley, says that whenever she sees him in another show or movie or something, that she wants to give him a hug because she associates him with her father. And by all people who saw Steven with his kids, they say he was an absolutely wonderful father. So I believe I said a little earlier that the name of the movie was from something he told the police, that he knew his first name was Steven. You know, and I think that's considering how much he was brainwashed over the years and that he had not been called that name, you know, Steven, for 7 years.